VOA News. I'm Steve Norman. Chief of the United Nations agency, which helps Palestinian refugees, is promising continued aid for Palestinians, even as the United States says it's ending its financial contribution to the agency. American University Professor Emeritus Russell Stone says the Trump administration made the decision to end funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency without consulting its Foreign Affairs and Middle East advisors.
Cutting the funding so drastically, up to 40% of the total support for UNRWA, could lead to unrest that could result in anti-Israel demonstrations, that could result in stimulating terrorist actions.
Trump administration cut funding to UNRWA, calling the organization irredeemably flawed. UNRWA provides health care, education, and social services to Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Pakistan has dismissed as incorrect reports the United States has canceled $300 million in military aid to the country, saying Washington owed the money to Islamabad for expenses incurred in fighting terrorism. The controversy is the latest to hit Islamabad's troubled relationship with Washington, coming a few days before Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is scheduled to visit Pakistan. At least six people were killed, including two children, after a suicide bomber detonated his vehicle outside a district headquarters in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. The bomber tried to speed through a checkpoint but was stopped by security forces. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. They often target the capital with bombings, including a truck bombing in October that left 512 dead. This is VOA News. The United Nations Refugee Agency warning asylum seekers and migrants from Africa who have come ashore on Greek islands are living in conditions unfit for human habitation. UNHCR spokesman Charles Yaxley tells VOA these conditions are having a devastating impact on people's well-being.
We are seeing increasing numbers of people, including children, presenting with mental health problems. We're seeing rising levels of sexual assaults because there is insufficient security in place in the sanitary facilities as well.
UNHCR is urging the Greek government to speed up the process of transferring these individuals to the mainland so they can receive proper care. There is a new U.S. NATO commander in Afghanistan. U.S. Army General Scott Miller has taken over commander from General John Nicholson.
The world recognizes that Afghanistan cannot be a safe haven for terrorism. The world recognizes we cannot fail. I know this has been a long fight, and it has been generational. For us, for the Afghan people.
General Miller is a former commander of the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command and said he is key to the success in the 17-year Afghan conflict. In Iraq, rival political factions say they each have formed alliances capable of leading the country's next government following a May election. One faction is led by Shiite cleric Moqtada al-Sadr, the other headed by militia commander Hadi al-Amiri. Government information process is expected to get underway later today. The late U.S. Senator and war hero John McCain was buried. It happened on Sunday at his alma mater, is where he went to college, the U.S. Naval Academy. After a week of remembrances like what his daughter Megan said at his memorial service when she spoke of the country her father proudly served.
The America of John McCain is generous and welcoming and bold. She is resourceful and confident and secure. She meets her responsibilities. She speaks quietly because she is strong. America does not boast because she has no need to. The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again because America was always great.
In his eulogy, former U.S. President George W. Bush said McCain was honorable, always recognizing that his opponents were still patriots and human beings.
The world is smaller for his departure, and we will remember him as he was, unwavering, undimmed, unequal.
Mr. McCain died on August 25th, age 81, after a year-long battle with brain cancer. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, September 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some analysts see opportunities and risk as the China-Africa summit gets underway in Beijing today, Monday.
China has a positive impact on Africa insofar as investment, in terms of trade, in terms of willingness to build infrastructure. The question that many of us have, however, is what debts are being run up?
J.P. DeFarm is Vice President of the Atlantic Council and Director of Its Africa Program. Rwandans are voting today in parliamentary elections that some call a rubber stamp. South Sudan's SPLA-IO in opposition say government forces continue to violate a ceasefire. And Ugandan protest at the White House as lawmaker Bobi Wine arrives in the United States to seek medical treatment.
We are protesting here at the White House, and as you've been seeing in other places, Ugandans everywhere across the world are having their voices heard, and we shall not stop until Museveni is gone.
Karim Chambe is a human rights activist and one of the organizers of Sunday's protest at the White House. And we'll get analysis of Liberia's new land rights law. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Chinese President Xi Jinping will today, Monday, open a two-day China-Africa Cooperation Summit with more than 50 African leaders in attendance. Trade between China and Africa was $170 billion, a 40% jump. During the last summit in 2015, China gave out $60 billion in assistance and loans to Africa. Burkina Faso's President Marc Christian Kabore told China's Xinhua Net that Africa has chosen China. J.P. DeFarm, Vice President of the Washington-based Atlantic Council and the Director of its Africa Program, says China's commercial links are reinforced with extensive diplomatic and military engagements. He cautions African leaders to use whatever commercial benefits they accrue to advance the interests of their respective countries, while at the same time being mindful of the debt trap.
Africa has a tremendous deficit in terms of infrastructure. It's particularly acute in power and transport, roads or railways. These are two things that if Africa could just arrive at the median of the rest of the world, we would see across the board almost 2% per year greater economic growth. China is one of the few countries in the world that's putting down significant funding for infrastructure in Africa.
You talk about the risk. What are the risks? Because it seems to me all the African countries or the leaders that are going there see this as an opportunity.
Yes, it certainly is an opportunity. But it's only an opportunity if those leaders negotiate hard for equitable terms and also transparent terms, what they are mortgaging. Because all too often, what happens is leaders look to the short term, what can be gained, even if they're not corrupt. We're talking about short term infrastructure that helps with one's reelection, all those things. And then the cost comes down the road when someone else is responsible. And there's already beginning to be a question of whether that is sustainable. To give you just one example, Djibouti, which now has borrowed just in the last 2 years over $1.4 billion. That's 75% of its GDP. How is it ever going to pay that back?
I was reading an interview with the president of Burkina Faso. He says that Africa has chosen China. What does that mean?
Well, I think that's a good question. What does that mean? Rhetoric is very nice, but at the end of the day, how is this put into practice? China has a positive impact on Africa insofar as investment, in terms of trade, in terms of willingness to build infrastructure. The question that many of us have, however, is what debts are being run up? We've just gone through a period where many African countries have achieved relief from their long-term debts, many of them to their former colonial rulers. But is this going to lead to a new debt? And don't take my word for it. Take the word of an African leader like the Emir of Kano, Lamido Sanusi, former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, who actually has described some of the terms of trade with China some of the financing as a new imperialism.
Looking at all this, as you mentioned in your piece, almost all of Africa has relations with China, with the exception of Eswatini or the former Swaziland. What does that do to the United States? In the past, they used to be seen like the United States was the leading player in Africa.
To the extent that the United States still has more embassies across Africa than any country in the world, the U.S. is still Africa's largest donor of aid as opposed to lender. I think that's an important distinction. Also, the U.S. position remains also open for developing equitable forms of trade. So I think that America offers something different. And for Africa, I think the most strategic thing to do is to balance the various offers that come forth, not just from the United States, not just from China, but also Europe and other partners in emerging economies to get the best mix for in each and every country. Its leaders need to be statesmen. They need to balance that and achieve what is in the long-term interest of their people, not just short-term political interests.
J.P. DeFarm is Vice President of the Washington-based Atlantic Council and Director of its Africa Program. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Rwandans are voting today in parliamentary election that some critics are calling a rubber stamp election, since they say President Paul Kagame's ruling Rwanda Patriotic Front Party is likely to win the majority of the 80 seats. The three opposition parties fielding candidates supported a constitutional amendment last year that took away term limit, making it possible for President Kagame to remain in power until 2034. President Kagame voted in China yesterday, Sunday, along with about 40,000 diaspora Rwandans. Charles Muyaneza is executive secretary of the National Electoral Commission of Rwanda. He says his commission is ready to administer the vote to over 7 million Rwandans across the country. He says the 1,300 international and domestic observers will prove that the polls were free and fair.
Just yesterday, we had the Rwandans in the diaspora voted. Today, we are expecting over 7 million Rwandans coming to cast their votes across the country, electing at least 53 members of parliament that mainly come from political parties and independent candidates. So, in general, we are prepared. We have already delivered all election materials at our polling sites. All the election staff and volunteers are already in place, and we are set for the polls.
You said you had a diaspora voting. How was the turnout? How independent was that?
It was as independent as always. We had over 40,000 Rwandans registered in the diaspora. The turnout was very high. Of course, we are still collecting reports. We shall be announcing results from the diaspora. At the same time, we shall be announcing results that were cast here in Rwanda. So that should be today after 3 p.m.
Charles, your critics are saying these elections are not truly independent. They are just window dressing because President Kagame or the ruling party controls everything.
I think we are getting tired of responding to these critics, but I wish those criticizing the system would be on the ground. Unfortunately, many of them are not here in Rwanda. We've got over 1,300 election observers on the ground. So let's wait and see what they will say, both domestic and international elections. But as far as we are concerned, Rwandans are happy with the system. It is a competitive electoral system. We've got over 521 candidates vying for 80 seats in the parliament, both political parties, independent candidates. So it's just as competitive as it is anywhere.
For example, some three political parties, the criticism is that they are allies of your ruling party, President Kagame's party.
If they were like that, they wouldn't be fielding candidates. What would be the point with them fielding candidates when they are alive? Of course, we have other political parties that are in a coalition with the RPF. Those do not field the candidates. So if those three have fielded the candidates, I don't see why people are saying that they are allied to the ruling party.
So you truly believe, your commission believes that these parliamentary elections are going to be truly independent?
They are as independent as ever, and we are happy that we got as many candidates. In fact, it's the first time in our history that we've got that large number of people competing for these seats in the parliament. So to us, it is independent because it is managed by an independent body, which is the National Electoral Commission, and we are as professional as any other independent election management body. I think even more independent than some of those that people are criticizing.
What's the level of female participation now in these parliamentary elections?
Very large, because out of 521 candidates that we have accepted as candidates, we have got 326 women candidates. So you can see the proportion and the percentage.
Thank you very much again, Charles, for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Charles Munyaneza is Executive Secretary of the National Electoral Commission of Rwanda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 3rd. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Ugandans in many cities across the world held protests yesterday, Sunday, to demand that two lawmakers who were badly beaten and allegedly tortured by security forces 2 weeks ago be allowed to leave the country for medical treatment abroad. One of those lawmakers, Robert Tshigulanyi, popularly known as Bobby Wine, arrived in the United States over the weekend and is now receiving specialized treatment in Boston. Human rights activist Karim Nchambe is one of the organizers of Sunday's protest here at the White House. He says their long-term demand is for President Museveni, in power for 33 years, to leave power peacefully.
Right now, we have Ugandans from all across the United States joining us in solidarity to protest the recent human rights violation by the government of Uganda. We can't even say it's the recent because it's been the ongoing human rights violation for the past 32 years. So right now, what we want in our short-term goal is to have some of our honorable members that were brutalized, let out of the country to receive adequate medical care. We need Museveni to go. We need him to step out of power peacefully. We are protesting here at the White House, and as you've been seeing in other places, in Boston, in London, in France, in Hong Kong, Ugandans everywhere across the world are having their voices heard, and we shall not stop until Museveni is gone.
Karim, tell me, there's news that the Honorable Bobby Wine is in the United States. Is that true?
Yes. Right now, Bobby Wine is receiving medical attention with his doctors. We cannot have him talk right now. He's having private medication. But once he gets back on his feet, he'll be able to come and let you know what exactly transpired during the ordeal. We also have Honorable Zake. As you hear in the background, everybody's chanting, free Honorable Zake. So all we need is to have Honorable Zake leave the country and receive adequate medical attention.
Karim, you know, following Ugandan politics, there have been several political people who have been arrested and tortured and sent to jail. For example, take Dr. Chisa Besigye. How do you see this Bobby Wine situation and the other members of parliament? Are they now becoming the rallying cry for your movement?
I think what the Honorable Bobby Wine helped the population to see was to let them see the situation in their own lenses. He gave power to the people. He helped people realize that what is going on cannot be let have few people lead it. The movement should be a movement that is done by all the people. Everybody should be responsible and have their voices heard. That's why so many young people across the country have been able to rally behind him, have been able to rally behind what he stands for. He's standing for unity, peace, and justice, and equality for all. So until we have that, we are going to still have this demonstration.
Now, I was reading an opinion piece from Uganda, which looked at historical political arrests that changed history. Do you all believe that the arrest of the Honorable Bobby Wine and Honorable Zaki, these are events that could change the history of Uganda?
I mean, you could never tell what changes, but today we see what happened by the arrest of the Honorable Bobby Wine and Honorable Zaki. Everybody's standing up because most of the time the government has been lying to us. They arrest our people, they kill them. For example, they say that they were arrested for trying to attack the presidential motorcade. They said, oh, they targeted stones towards the vehicle of the president. But this is a president whose soldiers killed Bobby Wine's driver. They told us a stray bullet killed the driver of the Honorable Bobby Wine. So we need answers. We need to know if it was a stray bullet, who was the target? Why would a stray bullet kill a driver who is just seated waiting for the boss to go?
Karim Nchambe is a human rights activist and one of the organizers of Sunday's protest at the White House. You are speaking with me from Washington, D.C. A week ago, the Liberian Senate passed the long-awaited law which expands land rights to rural Liberians to own their customary land. It prevents the government from leasing out land to concessionaires without the involvement of rural people in the negotiations. Ali Kaba from Liberia's Sustainable Development Institute talks to Ricky Stryer about the details of the new law.
So this actually is a big deal for Liberia because it has, for the first time now, presented an opportunity for communities to own their customary land rights. This presents opportunities for communities to be able to protect their land, their customary land, against external encroachment and also internal encroachment. So this is a big deal.
Can you give me the specifics of how this is different from the current land rights law and what that means for Liberia? I know a lot of the conflict in the past has come from land rights issues.
In the past, anyone could come in Liberia. You do not have to talk to community people that have lived on this land even before the Liberian states got established. You could come and talk to the central government, and the central government will give you a right and access to the land, and you just go on the land and remove people and start to do what you want to do. And what I meant is that communities were being displaced. It was affecting livelihoods. This had created a conflict between both the community and the government, but also between the community and external actors. So the law is saying for the first time that wherever you've lived for the past 50 years, and you've held customary rights to the land, and you can prove through the negotiation with your neighbors that you have access to this right and you've owned this right to the land, you can have legal ownership like any other legal rights that have been given to people in the past.
What kind of challenges do you think this might pose?
Yeah, so this concept of private ownership came with the state. Traditionally, people have access rights that is collectively owned either through a town the town is subdivided into quarters where quarters have rights to particular areas within a town. But the coming of the Liberian state created a condition that you have two types of land. You have people that have private rights to the land in which the government had isolated a piece of land and provided deed to people, or you have land that were not deeded were now considered as public land in which the government had absolute rights over and had used that right to give rights to concession companies and through that arrangement. So these companies now have been told that these lands are not occupied, and they came and signed contracts with the government. But as they have now realized that when you try to access the land, there are people on the land, there are people that have been living on the land long before the state. So that in itself created this serious conflict. So the new law now is saying that customary right is protected, but it's also going with the spirit to say that individuals within towns can have private rights in residential areas.
That was Ali Kaba of Liberia's Sustainable Development Institute. He was speaking with Ricky Stryak from Monrovia. A spokesman for the military wing of South Sudan's rebel SPLA-IO says the group has asked the Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangements Monitoring Mechanism to investigate continued attacks by government forces on rebel positions in Ye River State. Colonel Lam-Paul Gabriel says the attacks, which began August 29, continue into Saturday. He says the rebels are respecting the ceasefire signed earlier this year, but had to respond to the attacks in self-defense.
It happened on Wednesday, 29th August 2018. The government forces launched a very heavy attack on our position in Jamara, about 18 miles away from Ye town. They came from Ye. It was one of the heaviest attacks so far that we received throughout this year. They had P-10 with them, they had 12.7, they had two ATCs, that is anti-personnel carriers. They also had 80 and 60 millimeters rocket-propelled grenade launchers, plus this AK-47. And they continued with the attack on exactly Saturday. They attacked Kopera. The main aim of the attack is to install a commissioner of the regime in Kopera. They brought him from Ye to make sure that they establish him or install him in their new county to become the administrator of the commission in that area. We are talking peace here, finding things, but the regime is busy attacking us. giving problem to civilians, because Kupera is a big area for us under our control, and there were civilians who were there who already settled. So the attacks in Kupera displaced several civilians.
Colonel Paul, your forces and the government forces signed the ceasefire, which raised the hopes of many people that finally peace is coming. So what would you say to those South Sudanese who might be feeling discouraged because of this latest fighting?
We want them to keep that hope intact, because the ACLIO, we from the ACLIO, we are here to observe the ceasefire and to make sure we comply with each of these rules put clearly on that paper. We don't want to move the government to go and attack that person, but we are entitled to defend ourselves. What is very important is we want the government to also adhere to the ceasefire. They should respect this. They should avoid the issue of self-interest opposition that they are trying to gain.
Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the SPLAIO. You are speaking with me from Uganda's capital, Kampala. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the U.S. Open, where South Africa's Kevin Anderson crashed out of the U.S. Open tennis competition on Sunday after losing to Austria's Dominic Thiem in the round of 16. The ninth seed Thiem won in straight sets of 7-5, 6-2, 7-6 in 2 hours and 36 minutes. Fifth seed Anderson, who reached last year's final, headed into the encounter with a 6-1 win record against Thiem, but came unstruck on this occasion. Mali has won the first ever Federation of International Basketball Association Under 18 African Championship title after seeing off Senegal 78-76 in the Malian city of Bamako. Mali's Fosseni Drame came up with game high of 19 points and 6 rebounds in their winning efforts. Courtesy of qualifying for the final, both Mali and Senegal have qualified for the FIBA Under 19 Basketball World Cup in 2019. And now to athletics news. Former Kenyan marathoner Wesley Kuri, as well as world marathon record holder Mary Kitiani, have called on Athletics Kenya to step up their fight against doping. Close to 114 Kenyan athletes have tested positive to performance-enhancing substances, among other relating doping offenses, in the past 3 years, with 54 of them being sanctioned.
It is time for heads to start rolling and to make sure that those who are aiding and abiding doping in this country are taken seriously and kicked out of this country with immediate effects.
AK fraternity to take charge and actually keep away this kind of doping, because we will not go far if we try to cut a shortcut.
Staying with Kenyan athletics, Kenyan runners took both the men and women titles at the 7th International Marathon of Nixia in Yellow River Coast on Sunday in the Wanzhou city of northwest China. Cleopas Kipto-Chiriot took the men's crown in 2 hours, 26 minutes and 6 seconds, while Nancy Chipkiri snatched the women's title in 2 hours, 46 minutes, 19 seconds. According to the local organizers, the event featuring marathon, half marathon and mini marathon attracted some 20,000 runners, including 14 foreign runners. And now to volleyball. Egypt and Rwanda will represent Africa at the Women's Under 20 World Championships to be held in Mexico in 2019. Egypt won the finals to emerge champions after seeing off Rwanda in straight sets of 25-18, 25-10, 25-13 in the final at the Kasarani Indoor Arena on Sunday. Cameroon overcame Nigeria 3-1 in the third place match to clinch the bronze medal. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a productive week.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.